Thank you. Be seated.
Justice Hankinson has already had her say in this case and will not be sitting. Court is ready to hear argument from petitioner in Bryant versus United Shoreline.
May it please the court, Mr. Harold Gold will present argument for the petitioner. The petitioner is reserved 5 minutes.
May it please the court, we come to you this morning with an issue that I thought the court had clarified and determined in the Bard case. And yet, despite our best efforts before two trial judges and the Fort Worth Court of Appeals, that issue comes back before you today. To reach it, I'm going to have to delve into that murky abyss that is constitutional law. And no matter how we address the issue, whether in terms of full faith and credit, comedy, conflict of laws, choice of law, I believe that we have to reach a decision which is different from those reached by the trial court and the Fort Worth Court of Appeals. That is that the Tennessee liquidator of Anchorage Insurance Company should not have to defend against claims brought by, in essence, an agent in Tarrant County. Whether that suit is started directly by the agent, by way of interpleader, by bank holding funds, that money is rightfully placed within the registry of the court, Chancery Court in Tennessee, and administered by virtue of the scheme of regulation that Tennessee has adopted.
Could
be not unlike this state.
Yeah. Mr. Gold, if suppose that the insurance company has an ongoing dispute over whether or not some furniture should be delivered to their office. Let's suppose I've got a, let's see if I can articulate this. The insurance company has an office in Texas, as an example. It's not their home office, it's just an office in Texas. And they order some furniture to be delivered to that office from a company that's in Texas. And that company never delivers the furniture. Now the insurance company goes into receivership, it's in Tennessee, and it's a liquidator is appointed, and the liquidator is required to go after the assets. Can the liquidator file a lawsuit in the Chancery Court in Tennessee, serve the furniture company in Texas, and require them to respond in Tennessee and try their case in Tennessee over the possession of this furniture that this company dealt with a company that was in Texas, agreed to deliver in Texas? Can that company be required to go to Tennessee to litigate its interest over that furniture?
On an in personam level, only if the company in Texas had such contacts with the state of Tennessee that it would be sufficient for Tennessee to exert personal jurisdiction over the company.
Is there anything in the scheme of the insurance liquidation or insurance receivership or anything that would permit one state to have jurisdiction over parties involved in a business transaction in another state that is not directly related to the interest of insurance?
I would say no. It can't reach that far.
Okay, suppose, go one step further. In this case, there's an argument that the proceeds in this bank account, that there's a dispute over who owns the proceeds in this bank account that's in Texas. And one party the party that's suing says, this has nothing to do with an insurance company. It just so happens there was a joint account over here. But my complaint was against McGregor. And now I'm here wanting to stake out my claim. This Tennessee statute that's written, is there anything about the insurance scheme of things that would permit a liquidator or a conservator or a receiver in Tennessee to force this kind of litigation to be tried in Tennessee?
As I understand your example, yes, I believe so. That within the context of the business of insurance, that if by virtue of putting the company into receivership, the court with jurisdiction determines that all ties to all assets of the company in receivership are now within the custody of that court.
But aren't we litigating whether or not the funds in this bank account are property of the insurance company? Isn't that litigating the title to that, just like we'd be litigating the title of the furniture that should have been delivered but wasn't delivered?
Not in this case. That wasn't the issue. There was never an issue in this case whether the funds were titled in the name of Anchorage Insurance Company. The bank always admitted and took the position that the assets were in the name of Anchorage, and in fact, it started to transfer them to the receivership. There was never any claim by United Short Line that the money in those accounts titled Anchorage was anything other than Anchorage. In fact, by virtue of the fact that it brought a fraudulent conveyance action, it had to admit that Anchorage held the money. It may not have been rightfully done, but the fact was, as it existed, as it took the state of the fact, that money was in the name of Anchorage. Anchorage had the right to do it until some court determined that legal and equitable title should not be in Anchorage.
Under what circumstances would Texas have a receivership on this insurance?
Pursuant to, I believe, it's Section 13 of Article 21.28 of the Insurance Code, there has to be a sufficient number of claimants raising issue within the state of Texas that the Commissioner of Insurance determines it's within the state's interest to administer whatever assets are within the state sufficient to take care of those claims first before tendering the balance of the assets to the domiciliary estate. But there's also provision in the insurance code in that same ancillary receivership statute that it can enter into an agreement with the domiciliary to administer all at once, and that happens right here.
I think my question would be, are there situations where two or more states are all having receivers?
Yes, Your Honor. The last one I can think of was probably the first big receivership in the last 20 years was Mission Insurance Company, which is a large comp and daycare provider out of California.
Okay, but it's not the case here in the...
In fact, Texas specifically declined to start an ancillary receivership, as you saw from the amicus papers from the Department of Insurance. There were not sufficient interest here as to Anchorage for the state. And that's what makes this particular case so compelling, is that Texas has virtually no interest in this dispute.
But we come down to a question of law.
I believe it does, Your Honor.
And that's what makes this case hard. Assuming that it's good policy for some state to do this, we have a statute. And why did the Chancery Court in Tennessee exceed its authority?
I don't believe it could exceed its authority as a Chancery Court. As you've seen, and historically from courts of Chancery, their goal was to do the ultimate good, coming ultimately as part of the ecclesiastical courts. There conceivably was no boundary historically, other than God's law. They were the church's court. As developed in this country, of course, we have constitutional principles that would limit a chancery court. And I can't begin to expound before you the collateral nature of the Tennessee courts and how the Tennessee courts view the limits on chancery jurisdiction. But I have provided for you in the brief that the historical jurisdiction of the Tennessee courts arising from North Carolina, which gave it its grant of power, where its laws came from, encompassed everything the Chancery Court did here. And the Tennessee statute specifically authorized the Chancery Court to do what it felt needed to be done in the liquidation of the company. What arises in my mind is whether it's permissible for a Texas court or any other court to say to another court from another state, yes, you have subject matter jurisdiction, but we're going to inquire whether, in exercising that jurisdiction, you understood your own law and applied it correctly. I think that the full faith and credit clause prevents that kind of analysis. I think under the full faith and credit clause, when you go back historically, what the framers were attempting to do, it was to prevent that kind of republicanism from preventing the states from operating as a whole.
But surely if one court in Tennessee had decided the issue one way and then another court the opposite way, we'd have to pick.
You would have to pick how the ultimate court in Tennessee would view its law, not how Texas views its law. but how the court in Tennessee, just as a federal court in diversity would do on an unresolved issue, look to see how the highest court of the forum supplying the law would determine an issue. I have not found within the Fort Worth Court's opinion, and certainly wasn't at the trial level, how the Tennessee Chancery Court, exercising its jurisdiction, usurped its power. And as we've indicated to you, we believe that is the test under Tennessee law for whether or not the judgment would be void. I will concede to you, if a judgment is void, it need not be given full faith and credit. But what standards should a court in Texas undertake to determine whether or not it is void?
Let me ask you a question, Mr. Gold, on that issue. You have a Tennessee statute that's here, and the argument is that it is outside the scope of the statute, and if it's outside the scope of the statute, does it really make the order void or still voidable? And if the statute, as I read it, could be that the legislature enacting the statute just recognized the jurisdictional limits of its court. It has jurisdiction over a business that's domiciled in its state. It has jurisdiction over property of a business that's in its state, even if the company is not domiciled in its state. Isn't that simply recognizing the jurisdictional limits of the court, having jurisdiction over what's within its borders, as opposed to a chancery court in Tennessee attempting to take jurisdiction over parties in some other state involving property in some other state?
So in so far as you take it, Your Honor, but we have to bear in mind, you have a hybrid kind of regulation here. You have a statute which attempts to define authority of an equitable court, a court of chancery, and within that statute delegates to the court within statutory parameters of what it seeks to achieve, maximizing the public good of failed insurance plan. It gives to that court a chancery. They could have given it to a court of law. They did not. They specifically gave it to a chancery court to administer, given the vagaries that arise in an insurance receivership. It is impossible to draw a bright line as to what is going to happen in any one receivership. I've handled many. They are all different, and you can never predict what's going to happen in any one. And I think that's why, very purposefully and very wisely, they left to their chancery side the business of winding up the affairs of the company and doing what was needed. Whatever arose, in this case you had an offshore company, and yes, it had a bank account in Texas, but here you had a company that was incorporated, I believe, in Michigan, United Short Line. Its principal place of business was in Pennsylvania, which had sued in Florida against someone who had fled the country, and they were seeking to protect whatever they might recover in Florida from a bank account that existed in Texas. The bank account in Texas was comprised mostly of premiums from California drivers. Whatever interest Texas might have had, it should have ended with transferring that money to the one court in the country that had stepped forward in an attempt to administer the affairs of the insolvent company for the benefit of all policyholders. There can be no result here from the way the Fort Worth Court of Appeals has structured this other than to give United Short Line of preference. That is completely contrary to Texas policy. It's contrary to the state statute of Tennessee. In fact, it is contrary to every insurance and policy law in the country. No state has a policy interest in giving to a non-resident a preference over legitimate claimants. And in fact, in Barr, that was the determination of this court. As I read Bard, it is almost exactly applicable to the situation. And Bard had an agent who wanted to assert a counterclaim. United Short Line is no more than an agent here. It has brokered for various short line railroad companies insurance coverage. And it wants to recover money from Anchorage, which it claims is fraudulently the holder of premiums from a company, McGregor, which it claims is the alter ego of a bad guy it has a claim against in Florida. And in this particular case, the trial judge found that that Florida judgment of United Short Line wasn't even entitled to full faith and credit. It wasn't a final judgment. The only thing that was final and clear in this case is that Tennessee had stepped forward to attempt to administer the affairs of the company. We think it is only right and just that it not be piecemealed across the country by people with varying interests to achieve a recovery of assets to the detriment of other claimants. Obviously, United Short Line has traveled around the country. There's no reason it can't go to Tennessee. In fact, in this case, it has gone to Tennessee and disputed with the Chancellor his authority. The Chancellor has repeatedly affirmed his authority and is frustrated he can do nothing more with the state of Texas. The purpose of comedy was to avoid that frustration. As stated in the Articles of Confederation and in the Federalist Papers, which articulated the purpose of the Constitution, the idea was to bring the individual states together, have them work as a union. That purpose is frustrated here by the results from the trial court and the lower court of appeals.
Any other questions? Thank you, Hal. The court is ready to hear argument from respondent.
May it please the court, Mr. Cleaver Miller and Mr. Lawrence Ackles will present argument for the respondent. Mr. Miller will open with the first 10 minutes.
May it please the court, Mr. Ackles and I have divided this up so that it's my intention to give a general overview of our position here. He will talk in more detail about some of the cases that have been discussed here. The Tennessee Insurance Code provides rather clearly that if no domiciliary receiver has been appointed, that the commissioner may apply for an order to liquidate the assets found in this state. And that's a critical phrase, the assets found in this state of a foreign insurer or an alien insurer not domiciled in this state. The order of the Tennessee court found that Anchorage was an alien insurer not domiciled in Tennessee, so that the only statutory authority which the commissioner had was over the assets found in this state. The code also provided no court of this state has jurisdiction to determine any complaint for receivership, liquidation, or injunction other than in accordance with this chapter.
The Texas Attorney General takes a different view of that.
That's exactly right, Your Honor. The Texas Attorney General does not talk about the specific language of that code. The Attorney General talks about the general concept of insurance liquidation and how somehow to follow that, as the Court of Appeals did, violates some kind of concept of overall statutory scheme. And I think that what the liquidator's position would be in the face of that language myself, Your Honor, is just absolutely to ignore that and to say that the Tennessee legislature was making mud pies rather than making law when it wrote that language into the insurance code, that it has absolutely no meaning and no provision and you don't pay any attention to it.
Isn't there a judgment out of Houston domesticating the Chancery Court's order out of Tennessee?
There is, Your Honor. They came in and domesticated that order in Texas without making anybody parties and then gave notice of it. We believe the law is that a void order on its face is a void order on its face no matter where it's filed. And that if there is inherent vice in that judgment which makes it void, the fact that it's filed in other states doesn't breathe validity into an otherwise invalid order. And you've got to look at that order and the law of Tennessee, and if it's void on its face, which we believe it to be, then the fact that they filed it in Texas doesn't breathe any validity into it. And we've cited cases in our brief which I believe go to that point. I would like to try to make the point that every state has its own jurisdiction to handle insurance liquidations if it wants to. There's no overall nationwide scheme, but there is a general plan that has developed. And that general plan is, while it's not perfect, it's fairly straightforward, and it's fairly simple. And what it provides is that the primary right to liquidate an insurance company is in the state where it is domiciled, where it is either chartered or where it has become licensed and has the authority to do business. And the domiciliary state, which is not Tennessee in this case, the domiciliary state has a primary right. If the company that's placed in liquidation in the domiciliary state has assets in other jurisdictions, then there should be ancillary receiverships where those assets are, and the ancillary receivers handle those assets, handle the claims, and ultimately transfer the net assets to the domiciliary estate. It's much like a home office with some branch offices that are handling the business of this insurance company. Now, in just last week, I received a copy of the brief publication of the insurance section of the American Bar Association. It's got three good articles on insurance liquidation and insolvency. It generally points out this scheme that the primary right, so generally when the insurer is placed in receivership, the insurance commissioner of the insured's state of domicile will be appointed to serve as receiver. It goes ahead and talks about ancillary receivership. And forgive me for reading this, but it's short and succinct, I think. An ancillary receiver may be appointed in a non-domiciliary state in which the insolvent insurer maintains assets. The ancillary receiver marshals the local assets of the insolvent insurer, uses them to pay secured claims and claims against special deposits asserted by claimants residing in the ancillary state, and then to reimburse itself for the cost of administering the receivership. Excess funds are transferred to the domiciliary receiver and become part of the general assets of the estate. Other claimants in an ancillary state may adjudicate their claims. They exercise the option of having the ancillary receiver adjudicate their claims, provided the domiciliary receiver is provided with notice and an opportunity to contest the claim. This option is designed to afford the greatest convenience to the out-of-state claimant, so that at least for the purposes of allowance or disallowance of the claim, the claimant need not travel to or retain counsel in the state in which the insolvent insurer was incorporated. So that says that...
Let me interrupt. You represent the bank, and
yes.
The bank says the funds are not mine, it belongs to somebody else.
That's correct.
Now, what is your interest if they're litigated here in Texas or Tennessee? What do you care?
My interest is that they say we've got to go to Tennessee to file this interpleader action.
You send the funds to Tennessee, period. You know, what's that? Is that
we have to go down there.
Wire transfer the funds to the court in Tennessee. You know, what's the big deal?
Well, in order for us to be protected, we're faced with competing claims. There's another claimant, Mr. Ackle's client, who says these funds belong to them. If we just pay them voluntarily to the receiver, then we may be liable.
Well, you're not paying voluntarily. The receiver's making a claim.
But we're volunteering to pay that claim rather than asking the court, is that a legitimate claim? Nobody has ever decided yet that these are the funds of Anchorage. That's the issue in this case. Do they belong to Anchorage? Are these people entitled to them? The bank doesn't care. The bank's a stakeholder, and that's the traditional concept of interpleader. A stakeholder faced with multiple claims, in order to protect itself, has the right to go in and invoke the in-rem jurisdiction of a court saying, here are the assets, judge, decide who's entitled to these. Now, the state of Tennessee liquidator can decide we're not going to make claim to those, we're not going to Texas. or it can come to Texas to lay claim to those assets. It can do whatever it wants to, but a Texas citizen with assets in Texas that has no connection with the state of Tennessee shouldn't be required to go to the state of Tennessee simply to invoke the in rem jurisdiction of a court to protect itself from multiple claims that are being made against it.
I just find it difficult to understand your interest in the whole situation.
Well, our interest is simply not to be exposed twice to paying this money, to wrongfully paying the money. And if we voluntarily give it to one of the competing interests, then we met and we're wrong, they're not entitled to it. If the ultimate decision in this case is that Anchorage doesn't own those funds, we've given them to the wrong party.
They have the label Anchorage all over them.
There are no facts in this record which indicate that top side or bottom.
Counsel made a speaking out of school, out of the record.
Counsel, I believe if you'll look at this record, that is their claim. I think that there are competing claims, which I believe I understood him to say, is that these people are saying that some of the transfers that were made into the name of Anchorage were fraudulent and should be set aside, and they are entitled to the money. So that there are competing claims, even though their Anchorage names may be on some of it. There are competing claims to the ownership of the funds. We don't have a stake in that. They don't belong to us. We simply want to be protected. The banks in First Texas invoked the in rem jurisdiction of the Texas court. If they're right, no court anywhere in the world, could involve Anchorage on any kind of issue. They would have to go to the receivership and let the receiver answer the question of whose funds there are. That seems to me to be an extremely incongruous situation that's not consistent with any concept. Now, I also believe, Your Honor,
your time is
okay, I thought it was green light coming on. I'm sorry.
Questions? Thank you, counsel.
I'd like to take just a moment to introduce my co-counsel, Mr. Joseph Ackles, and my 15-year-old son, who's on holiday from school and is with me in the courtroom today. Evan. Your Honor, we appear today not only on behalf of our client, Diane Shortline, but also on behalf of our deceased colleague and very good friend, Jerome Ferguson, who was both trial counsel and counsel of the Court of Appeals for United Shortline below. We've inherited this case and believe that he's with us in spirit today as we argue this case in court. I think that, quite frankly, the real issue before this court is whether or not a void judgment or a judgment void on its face is ever entitled to full faith and credit or is entitled to be given effect under principles of comity. And I think that a careful reading of the Tennessee statutes which govern the outcome of this case gives rise to that question. The statute is very clear and unambiguous that in the case of a foreign insurer or an alien insurer not domiciled in the state of Tennessee, the court only can liquidate or order the commissioner to liquidate assets found in the state of Tennessee. There is a complete statutory scheme in Tennessee for the liquidation and rehabilitation of insurance companies. And in fact, they have specific provisions that are domestic insurers, specific provisions that apply to foreign or alien insurers domiciled in the state of Tennessee, and the provision that applies to this case of an alien insurer not domiciled in the state of Tennessee. And in each case, the jurisdiction of the court is different. A domestic insurer, the Tennessee court has jurisdiction of assets found anywhere. An alien or foreign insurer not domiciled in the state of Tennessee, the commissioner or the court has jurisdiction of assets found in the United States. And in the case, as we have here, of an alien insurer not domiciled in Tennessee, the bright line is drawn at the borders of the state of Tennessee, and the court does not have jurisdiction of any assets outside the state of Tennessee. Now, I've listened to the, going back to the Magna Carta about the authority of the Chancery Courts, and I agree the Chancery Courts do occupy a very sacrosanct place in our common law heritage. However, we are dealing with a specific act of the Tennessee legislature. And I think that to give efficacy to that act and to read that statute as to have any effect whatsoever, it is clear that these assets that we're arguing about located in the state of Texas are beyond the purview of the Tennessee court. The Bard decision, which has been cited by the petitioner in support of its position as being on point here, is totally not on point, because the Bard decision, which we believe was entirely and correctly decided and properly decided, dealt with a Vermont order that was in the process of liquidating a Vermont corporation, a corporation chartered in Vermont. And there was a specific statute that's cited by this court in its 1992 Bard decision at footnote 1, which said, which gave the Commissioner of Insurance in Vermont the authority to wind up all affairs with title to all of the assets of any such insurer against which delinquency proceedings have been commenced. Because that was a domestic Vermont corporation, the court had authority to exercise jurisdiction over assets located outside the state of Vermont. And this court gave that order full faith and credit. If we were talking about a domestic Tennessee corporation chartered in the state of Tennessee, we would not be arguing this case today, because the judgment would be entitled to full faith and credit. But as Justice Heck pointed out, I think there are Tennessee cases which point out that a court that exercises jurisdiction where it has none essentially gives rise to a void order which is subject to collateral attack. In the Brown case, Brown versus Brown is one of those cases that we think is directly on point, because in that case, the Tennessee Supreme Court held that a court order which awarded alimony when it was not authorized to do so by statute was the author of a void order that was not enforceable and could be collaterally attacked. We think the same situation applies here. Because the Tennessee order is void on its face in that the court usurped power which it did not have, that is, the attempt to exercise jurisdiction.
Do you agree that that's the standard, usurp power?
I think it is the standard, Your Honor.
And the Northern District just misapplied it, or?
Well, Your Honor, I'm glad you brought up Judge Fitzwater's opinion, because I've read that, and I know Judge Fitzwater, I think, in that case, if you read the opinion carefully, was struggling mightily not to rule on the merits of that case. And so what he did, basically, is take the standard, which is the erroneous exercise of power granted as opposed to the usurpation of power where none exists, and basically found a Seventh Circuit opinion and grafted on top of that another standard, which is reasonable misinterpretation of the law as opposed to an egregious misinterpretation of the law. Either standard, by either standard, we think in this case, how could it be an any more egregious misinterpretation of the law than to exercise jurisdiction in the face of specific statutory prohibition? I think that Judge Fitzwater was tiptoeing very carefully in an area perhaps of federal versus state court jurisdiction, and perhaps he would rather have this decided in Tennessee or by some other state court, and simply did not want to reach a decision on the merits, because quite frankly, in the last couple of paragraphs, he said that he was troubled by the record, and I think that if he had to reach a decision on the merits, I think the decision would be not to give it full faith and credit. But the fact is, Your Honor, that this court maybe does not have the luxury of Judge Fitzwater, because now it's right in your lap and some decision needs to be made here. I think that it would be an even greater mistake for the Supreme Court of Texas to give full faith and credit to a judgment void on its face than to do any of the things which either the petitioner or the Attorney General say would cause all of these problems. I don't think it would cause any problems. I don't think the petitioner has been able to cite a single case to this court of devastating impossibility of liquidation as a result of applying this narrow scenario or addressing this narrow issue, which involves only an alien insurer not domiciled in the state. The order of this court can be tailored very narrowly to fit just the specific facts of this case, and I don't think it would have a detrimental effect on the interstate liquidation of insurance companies.
How does the result you argue for, how can that be made consistent with the result in the Bryan v. Shields case out of the Dallas Court of Appeals?
Well, and Judge Hankins, the Bryan versus Shields case, first of all, and I think the biggest distinction in that case is that it did not involve assets located in the state of Texas. We are dealing here with a quasi-in-rem situation where we have specific identifiable assets over which, in this case, the Texas court exerted jurisdiction. In the Shields case, the Shields law firm had performed legal services on behalf of an insured of Anchorage and didn't get paid. And so they submitted, basically they sued to collect their legal fees. That was a claim, first of all, directly against Anchorage. This case does not involve a claim directly against Anchorage. The claim being made here is to assets located in the state of Texas. Furthermore, in that case, the law firm occupied the position merely of an unsecured creditor, and Judge Hankinson, really, Justice Hankinson spent as much time arguing, deciding whether or not it was a final judgment than anything else in that opinion. And so I don't think that those are apples and oranges, because we are dealing with assets here, clearly identifiable, located in the state of Texas, and that's what makes them outside the scope of the Tennessee statute.
Any other questions? Thank you, Counsel.
Your Honor, I will give due deference to Mr. Apples that he is in an unfortunate circumstance only in the case of a few days. However, his attempt to distinguish the Shields case is profoundly wrong. Mr. Shields went out and garnished bank accounts at Lockwood National Bank and Surety Bank, Mr. Miller's client. That is how Shields, Britton, and Frazier is involved in this case. There were assets in this state. Justice Hankinson was right. The Tennessee order was entitled to full faith and credit. There's no basis to distinguish it, and the attempt by the Fort Worth court completely missed the mark. Let me also point out...
What about the argument that the suit was specifically against Anchorage here in the previous case? And that's a distinguishing feature from this case.
I think that's a distinction without a difference, Your Honor. Look what has happened here. Well, I have to back up. This may be a long answer. There were never any claims at the time this lawsuit started against Anchorage. There were no claims against the bank. If you look at the chronology I give to you, all that United Short Line sought to do was get two accounts at Surety Bank that it thought Mr. Griffith had control over. There was no suit against the bank. There was no suit against Anchorage. What happened subsequently is that Anchorage went into receivership. And yes, those were domesticated in Texas. And contrary to what Mr. Miller said, the bank was given notice. However, it was not made a party. There was no reason to make it a party. More importantly, there was no reason to have an ancillary receivership because Anchorage was not domiciled in any state in the country. The Department of Insurance for the state of Texas did attempt to start it. And a cease and desist order issued out of the 331st District Court here in Travis County. And what did the bank do? The bank ignored it. For all of his reading about ancillary receiverships, the plain fact is Mr. Miller's client ignored the very ancillary receivership he said should have been started. The state did start it and then find it didn't need one.
If the Tennessee statute read found only in this state and not in any other state, would that be clear enough to not give this order full faith and credit?
No.
Is there any way it could be?
Is there any way the Tennessee
statute could be clear enough that this court's order would not be entitled to full faith and credit?
I don't know how the legislature can write it, especially when dealing with the case here. We have an offshore company. No state in the union has stepped forward. Tennessee did. I don't know how a legislature can conceive of that circumstance when someone is going to decide where policyholders are not getting paid, where creditors are going without payment, how to construct that statute so that somebody won't challenge it. And I think that's the very reason that we have the concepts of full faith and credit and comedy. If the people of Texas thought that it should have happened through their designated representative, the State Department of Insurance, they would have started that ancillary receivership. They went through the start of the process and found that it was not needed because Tennessee was addressing the issue.
There weren't even any policyholders in Texas of Anchorage.
Well, following up on Justice Heck's question, Mr. Miller makes a strong argument that the Chancery Court only has those powers given to him by statute, and the statute clearly says you have the power to liquidate assets found in this state, period.
And to take such other steps as you deem appropriate. Mr. Miller only wants to read, as did the Fort Worth Court of Appeals, Section 402A. You have to read 402C as well. If you're going to do, as we've heard today through all three cases, don't read a statute so as to read it, render it meaningless. Don't render this one meaningless as well. There's a reason that the Tennessee legislature stuffed that provision in there.
Well, why could they not have written it excluding those three words in this state? Wouldn't that solve the whole problem?
I don't know that it would, Your Honor. As I said to you, I don't know how a legislature can conceive of every business that is or may be doing business there and attempt to address the statute for that. I think that's why they have included a chancery department to administer it. I can't speak to what the legislature in Tennessee might have been thinking, but I know that if you look at all the statutes in each of the states, none goes that distance.
Any other questions? Thank you. That concludes the argument in this cause. The foregoing causes are submitted on briefs and oral arguments. The marshal will adjourn the court.
All right. Oh, yeah, oh, yeah, oh, yeah.